Talk given Sunday, 21st November, 1971. Let us try out an extended meditation session to start with. Let the body be perfectly at ease. As free as possible from all muscular strains and tensions. Breathe easily and comfortably. Just a very gentle breath rhythm. No question of deep breathing exercises about it. Let the neck and the lower jaw be quite at ease. The lower jaw will tend to drop, but keep the mouth closed. And just be quietly aware for a few seconds of the breath as it goes in and out. And let the whole psychophysical organism be permeated by ease. A sense of comfort in the true sense, in the true meaning of that word, which means with strength. Comfort means with strength. And the strength which is completely at ease is perfect resilience. The very happy and invincible state of non-opposition. Which means the absence of all conflict. Perfect ease, elasticity, resilience, poise. Now let us be aware of this psychophysical organism which bears our own name in the world, starting from the base of the spine right up to the brain. Life energy thrills through it, through the spine. Brain and nerves are very important indeed, as we all know. Just feel life moving rhythmically up and down. And also vibrating in dynamic poise, free of the limitations imposed by directional movement. Let us remember, this is imaginative, but the imaginative has its psychological influence, and through the psychological influence, it brings the body to a state of as complete harmony as is possible for us as we are. Therefore, this perfect rhythm of life through the whole spine, base of the spine to the brain and down again. And the rhythm of the breath as the important conveyor of life, life energy to the entire organism, body and psyche. Now, those of you who were here last time may recollect that we spent some time considering the nature of mind in its own sphere, pure mind as it is called in much religious literature. Not pure merely in the moralistic sense, but mind in itself, an unknown energy or power with which you and I cannot deal, but which deals unto us. The power or energy which is formless, without limitation, infinite, holding within itself all the possibilities of finite manifestation, development, growth, and fruition. This pure mind meets the psychophysical organism in what the yogi and in yoga is called the Sahasrara Chakra, the crown circle. Chakra literally means circle, associated with the cerebrum, the brain. Pure mind, infinite, absolute, eternal, immortal, meets matter there. This is not to be taken as a statement of a scientific fact. This is a way of looking, a way of understanding. And again, using symbolical language, pure mind never descends further downwards in us as we are. Only in the perfected Holy One there is no differentiation between pure mind and body. Mind and body are the complete unity, the complete expression of divinity. But just let consciousness rest in the idea of pure mind touching the body at the brain center, a psychical center, not just the physical brain. The rest of the organism is the organism as it exists in the manifested world. In the world of duality, of confusion, conflict, of uncertainty, of pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow. The world which we as we are find ourselves as imprisoned divinity. That's the rest of the organism. Now again, in yogic terms, at the base of the spine is said to reside the storehouse of energy, psychical energy, which, when rightly awake, moves upwards and ultimately meets pure mind at the brain center. There are 7 centers in all. Do remember, this is a symbolical presentation, but it does bear relation to physical reality itself. The second center, the root center at the base of the spine, is called the Mooladhara. Root support is its meaning. The second one, situated at the genitals, is called Svadhisthana. The meaning of that word is own abode. And the third one, associated with the region of the navel, is called the Manipura. Pura means fortress, Mani means a gem. The place of the fortress, the jeweled fortress. It's a curious title. It is associated with all the commerce of the world that is ours during our physical lifetime. I'm not using the word commerce merely in the sense of shopkeeping and buying and selling and all that sort of thing. The commerce which takes place within our own body. In all esoteric religious teachings, the word world stands for, first and foremost, your own psychophysical organism. So you will see that these three centers are associated fundamentally with what we call the animal life of the body. Manipura deals with food and digestion and so forth. The preservation of the body, therefore, the preservation of the vehicle of the whole self. Svadhisthana deals with the perpetuation of the species. It is also, Svadhisthana is also the main root of isolative self-consciousness, the feeling of separate I-hood. I am I and not whatsoever belongs to the not-self. Therefore, you'll see at once that it is a source of conflict, the self and the not-self. It is a source of egoistic self-assertion. And as we all know, the supreme expression of egoistic self-assertion, howsoever it may be sublimated, etherealized by human beings, is in sexual action which perpetuates the species. If one can fully understand this, one begins to see the profound aspects of celibacy and its significance. But if celibacy is practiced desirously, that is to say, with the intention of gaining power or gaining anything whatsoever for yourself or for any other person too, inevitable failure results. There must be no selfness involved in such motivation. Then only celibacy can release its own fruit in terms of spiritual realization. So now these three centers deal with what we call our worldly life, in which the animal body is fully active and alive. The next center is what is called the heart center, anahata. The place of sound which is heard without any two objects striking. That is one of the wonderful things about this center. And it is at this center that we are at the fully human level. Human not as defined by the world, but human in the religious meaning, the inner religious meaning. Very few people indeed are fully awake in this sense. What is the meaning of this word human? From the root man, the Sanskrit man, meaning to think. But this thinking is not discursive talk. All that we call thinking is just discursive talk, a flow of words. And words are completely bound to the limited sphere of duality, subject to space and time, to beginning, proceeding, ending, to the finite, to the mortal. That's what words deal with. So it's not thought in that sense. It's thought in quite a different sense. Thought is creative power. That is what thought is. If we look into the major scriptures of the world, we will find accounts given of creation. These accounts simply do not fit into our scientific knowledge of the world and its emergence, the emergence of cosmos out of chaos. Science is concerned with the world as we see it with our eyes around us. Religion is concerned with the world which is within ourselves. And all the accounts of creation in the religions of the world deal with the creation of this world inside our own selves. This is what we must bear in mind very carefully. And thought, again I say, not discursive chatter, but that intense state of consciousness which is free of all the limitations imposed upon it by knowledge, by our experience of the finite and the mortal and the limited. Now, consciousness in that state is creative power. And creative power means creation. You may remember we did consider this point last time. The identity of creative power with creation. The one has no meaning apart from the other. So this is the meaning of man. Man is truly creative power, creative thought, creative action. That is what he really is. And it is at this heart center that he finds the fullness thereof. Now we move up a little bit. The next center, the Vishuddhi, the utterly purified Vishuddhi, It's the throat center, as we call it. And it is from this center. Again, do remember, this is all symbolical. It is from this center that there emerges what is called prophetic speech. Prophetic speech has nothing whatsoever to do with the foretelling of the shape of events to come. Prophetic speech is that speech which so stimulates the listener that some sort of revelation of transcendence takes place in him. That is prophetic speech. And it is from this center that such speech emerges. Now remember that speech, whatsoever it may be, ordinary everyday speech, or this extremely rare phenomenon of prophetic speech, is still speech, the word. And the word, though it itself may stand for the illimitable, the infinite, the absolute, the word nevertheless is limitation and finitude. So we come to the next higher center, which is called the Ajna center, the center of true wisdom, the wisdom which is divine wisdom. Again, one of those difficult phrases, not easy to grasp, to understand. One mustn't try to understand it intellectually. That is to say, logically, analytically, trying to make a perfect word structure out of it, because it will inevitably fail. You cannot make a word structure. You cannot make an image, a picture, of that which is imageless, which is beyond all pictures, simply by virtue of its own infinity. So this Ajna center, which is just under the brain, itself. And the brain, the thousand-petaled lotus, Sahasrara. That is the realm of divinity itself. Pure mind, you can call it the divine mind if you like. The Buddhist term is pure mind. The Zarathustrian term is vahumano, the good mind. In the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, you will find the phrase all father mind, which is God. All refers to this. Now this teaching is usually presented in terms of a movement upward from the base of the spine to the crown of the head. I would like, and I do it quite arbitrarily, to ask you to look at it in a slightly different way. Take the three lower centers, as they are called. Lower, not in any derogatory sense at all. Take the three lower centers, the Muladhara, Svadhisthana, Manipura. Now, take the spine. It is convenient to just visualize the spine. They are situated, we'll say, at certain vertebral levels of the spine. Take those three and bend them upwards with anahata, the heart center, as the point of bending, and place those three opposite the three higher centers, Vishuddhi, the throat center, Ajnaya, the center just below the brain associated with the medulla, as some would like to say, and Mooladhara, the root support, face to face with Sahasrara. Just sort of visualize it. Now, can you see the picture in imagination? Now, Mooladhara is power itself, which is dormant usually. And through our lives, through the lives of the vast majority of human beings, it remains completely dormant. In those of us in whom there come flashes of inspiration, in all creative artists, scientists, philosophers, some tremendous insight bursts out, then something of that energy, so to say, touches right up to Sahasrara, the top. That's why I turned them round like that and have made the three lower ones face the three upper ones. And the act of genius, the creation of genius comes forth then. Now this happens. Oneself has no control over it. Except when one is the perfected yogi. Now, Svadhisthana is opposite Ajnaya in this turned up position. All right. Now, we have spoken a bit about Svadhisthana and what it represents, especially sexuality in manifestation, and it is opposite Ajnaya. Now, this psychical energy, this power, is usually symbolized as coiled up like a serpent. And the serpent strikes at the base of the spine and goes upwards. But that is in the actual practice of the yogi. We'll leave that out altogether. Don't make any such attempt in any fashion, unless you know exactly all about it and can do it safely. But placing the centers opposite the upper centers is an interesting way of coming to understand certain things. Now, Svadhisthana is opposite Ajnaya. Ajnaya is the center which stands for Indra, one of the Rig Vedic gods, one of the high gods, Indra. Indra is the wielder of the thunderbolt. Indra represents the peak point of realization of selfhood. Selfhood not in the unfortunate sense of the word, but selfhood in the sense of actual being and the significance, the pure, the perfect significance of being. That's what Indra represents. Now in the Rig Veda, you will find again and again the statement, and remember there are something like 250 hymns out of the 1,017 which are dedicated to Indra. Indra is the ruler at Ajna, and what he does is to strike at the dragon of the deep, Ahi, A-H-I, to strike at the dragon of the deep with his thunderbolt. That dragon withholds the waters. This is the very interesting symbolism. Withholds the waters of life. And therefore the soul is parched. It suffers from drought. When Indra strikes at the dragon of the deep, and remember that Svadhisthana is the center whose element is water, just as Mooladhara, the base of the spine, is earth, then Svadhisthana is water. Water representing the water of life, the stream of life. Life in the spiritual sense, not just in the biological sense. So now, when Indra strikes at the dragon of the deep, the waters are let loose. Now, surely we begin to understand something there. This limited, egoistically assertive selfhood, whose supreme expression lies in the overwhelmingly sensational indulgence of one's sexual potency, withholds spiritual realization from the individual. Now, don't for a moment think that one can therefore, as a personal ambition, as an exalted desire, strike at the dragon of the deep. It's a profound error. The dragon of the deep is no enemy whatsoever. These are all symbolical ways of talking, and only with extraordinary wisdom and with extraordinary compassion and understanding can we penetrate into this mystery. When Indra, who is the Lord of Heaven, the personal Lord of Heaven in the Rig Veda, strikes at the dragon of the deep, Ahi, the serpent, what he does in actual fact is to utilize that energy for fertilizing the entire world field, which is man himself as he is here in the world, as a psychophysical organism. Now, the serpent lets go the waters of life, and they move upwards, symbolically speaking. Upwards meaning aspiration, perfection, purity, and all the rest of it. So now, we come to this very, very significant and important point as far as the living of the religious life is concerned. It is not the attempt to suppress, to repress, to hurt, or, most foolish of all, to try to annihilate the life of selfhood, which releases one into perfect communion with the Absolute All. It is not that. It is an allowing of this life energy, which is locked up in us and expressed largely only in animal form. It is a case of releasing this and letting it climb to the supreme heights of humanity, which means sinlessness. Sinlessness means non-separation from the totality. The first meaning of sin is separation from the totality, the one total reality. And in that process, this selfhood, which expressed itself previously in terms of grasping, limiting, spoiling, destroying, this very selfhood opens out in vision to embrace the whole universe in consciousness. You can't do it in any other way. You become completely and totally aware of the whole. And in that awareness, your relationship with everything that there is a perfect relationship, because you are absolutely open to everything. You set up no barriers whatsoever. Then the waters of eternal life fertilize you, the human, and in that, out of that fertilization, there emerges the tree of life. And you will find that that tree of life is the same as that other tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, of which we taste the fruit, ignorant of the significance and meaning of the tree of life, and therefore remain confined to duality, conflict, misery, sorrow, and non-humanity. Now, you will find that Manipura, the third center from the base of the spine upwards, deals with the commerce of the life's, of the body's life. Food, digestion, health, and all the rest of it. Now, this commerce of the body's life, when you turn up the spine like that, stands opposite Vishuddhi, the throat center. And Vishuddhi is the commerce of the spiritual life, the creative word of power, prophetic speech which reveals transcendence. So there is this commerce, this interchange, interaction between man and God. And these two, standing opposite to each other, as polar complementaries in perfect harmony, rest upon anahata, the level of man, the human here. When that takes place in perfection, then you as the individual are wholly and truly individual and have completely fulfilled the purpose of your existence, which no politician, economist, philosopher, thinker, good-hearted fellow can ever make you understand. Because he doesn't know it himself. Transcendence has come home right within you yourself. Now that is looking at it in terms of yoga. Let us look at it in terms of the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah is the primordial root of the whole of the Judeo-Christian tradition, hardly known to the Christian world, and what little is known in a very limited, obscure form. But there are certain things which you and I can understand. What I am going to say now is understood in the Judaic world, where the Kabbalah is a very serious, not merely object of study, but a way of life to live. The Supreme, the Absolute, is Yahweh. The conventional Orthodox Jehovah is an anthropomorphized concept of this infinite, unknown Absolute, named Yahweh. Someday we might go into the reason why this particular name was chosen, but that's in the lap of the future. Yahweh is this Absolute, this incomprehensible deity. As such, simply because it was the Jewish linguistic tradition all along the line, the Kabbalistic tradition too, Yahweh is referred to as He. Yahweh in His own absoluteness is He. Yahweh in manifestation as grace, mercy, and wisdom, when discovered by you, the person, as such, is termed you. And when one sees Yahweh in full manifestation, in all His glory, the Shekinah, which is His world, His perfect world of creation, He is referred to as I. Then Yahweh says I, when the creation is completed. And remember, this creation has nothing, has practically no relationship of what the world of men have understood as creation. This is all within the realm of spiritual realization in innermost consciousness. So, he, you, and I. Now let us relate this to ourselves. As you know, in Genesis, with the first chapter, we have the word Elohim used, not Yahweh, in the first chapter. Elohim is the word. Elohim is compounded of Ele and Mi, M-I. M-I, Mi. Ele is the eternal what, the infinite, immortal object. The Mi is the eternal who, the infinite, immortal subject. These two are in continuous interaction in what I like to call timeless conjugation. Elohim is the living representation of the incomprehensible, infinite, formless, unmanifest Yahweh. Now, here we get a wonderful glimpse into the meaning of the word and of thought. You all know how in the first chapter of Genesis it is stated, "And Elohim said, let there be light. And there was light." Instead of the word said, we really should have the word thought. And Elohim thought. Or perhaps even better, we should use the word mind as a verb. And Elohim minded, let there be light. And immediately there was light. Creative action. Now this ties up with the Vedic teaching of man, meaning to think in the sense of to create. So, and Elohim said, let there be light, and there was light. And then further down in that same chapter, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own image. Remember, Elohim is dual, the eternal who and the eternal what. And Elohim made man, male, female, each single man, each single woman, male, female. So again, the duality. Now try and sense this. Elohim made man in his own image. But this image is not inanimate. It is alive with the life of Elohim. Man is Elohim. As Eckhart said, absolutely unequivocally, man truly is God. God truly is man. So you see, coming back again to man as he is here, this very body, this psychophysical organism. the life of Elohim, the manifested expression of Yahweh, runs right through us. In actual fact, we are ignorant of it. Now please do remember, ignorant not merely in the intellectual sense. If I use these words, and if you are prepared to accept the words as true, intellectually you know it, but that's utterly useless. You can't do anything with it. So, although one intellectually knows, one is still helplessly and hopelessly ignorant. This knowing is something which emerges out of the innermost depths of consciousness. When the process of purification of our whole being has reached its culmination, absolute purity has to underlie the yogi's life, the life of any religion whatsoever. So, we being in the state of ignorance, unawakened, unenlightened, cannot realize nirvana, cannot be in the kingdom of heaven, which is our actual birthright and which awaits emergence into perfect manifestation through each and every single human being. So now, Elohim made man in his own image. That pure creative mind meets matter in man, the man here. Now we have what we call our psyche. Pure mind, God, if you like to use the word, use any word you like, but pure mind, meeting matter, this material body which is ours, gives mind shape to the organism. What we call our minds, our psyche, is personal to us. It is perhaps better if, as the years go on, we avoid saying our minds and talk only of the psyche. The psyche is the consequence of the meeting of this infinite, one and only universal energy, which is mind, with material things which are, of which there are an infinite number of manifestations of an energy of a different sort, energy which the scientist knows of and can utilize and can control. This transcendent energy of mind, man cannot utilize and control. It controls us. But when it is in interaction with this other energy, because of which there are innumerable forms, in the form which we call the human, there emerges the special manifestation of mental activities, mental processes. The Buddhist analysis is a most remarkable analysis of the man here on earth, the earthly man. That's why that has its own special value as such. There are many other ways of looking at it, And as you, those of you who have come here through the years, know very well, I constantly hark to the Judeo-Christian teaching for the very simple reason that that is your actual heritage. Your very body, the very cells of your body, the brain and the nerves and the glands and everything, carry that heritage in themselves. So we cannot cast it aside. Wisdom lies in understanding it, and in understanding other heritages and relating them one to the other. Then there is harmony and peace, because the wholeness is there then. That's why I talk about the Judeo-Christian heritage, and especially about the Kabbalah so frequently. Now, mind meets matter, and there is the phenomenon of the psyche. The psyche represents our impressionability. All influences which come upon this organism, oneself, from outside, or which arise from within through desire, memory, anticipation, etc., all these constitute the psychical life. They are all living forces within the psyche. And it is these living forces in the immediate here now which constitute what in Indian terms we talk of as our karma. Now, quite mistakenly, we separate out past, present, future. We are conscious, we are truly alive only now, in this very moment, the indefinable moment. And when awareness comes to its perfection, to its culmination, that awareness is no different from actual being. And that being is in terms of immortality and infinity, in terms of eternity, in which there is no time direction, a movement from a past to the present and into a future. But the psyche here and now actually lives in the immediate now. So to think in terms of past karma working itself out is an inadequate way of seeing the actual fact. The immediate now is the whole of karma. The world process is an emergent process. And this emergence is not a movement from here to there in space, or from past to present in, and then on into the future in time. It is not like that. It is space-time welded into one total unity to which we have to become, which we have to learn to see clearly. So now, this karma of ours which we talk about consists of all kinds of conflicting elements and forces productive of further conflict and misery. And it is a profound error to fight against it. All conflict, and particularly all conquest, breeds further conflict and the necessity for further conquest, as the ignorant, the foolish man would say. It is not a question of conflict, conquest. It is not a question of getting rid of the evil, the unhappy. and producing the good. This is a separatist viewpoint by an egoistically assertive self. That way lies only further sorrow and misery. Our task is to see the truth of things, understand quite clearly, and in that understanding there is the transformation of all the energy of life in us. This mysterious psychical energy which the yogi talks of, this divine life which the religia of all the religions talks of. To understand that and to let that work the transformation. I can't produce the perfect. I as a limited I. Only totality releases perfection. What I can do is not to obstruct it. Now, to keep quiet, to be still, and you know that wonderful verse in the Psalms, I think it is Psalm 40, verse 10, be still and know that I am God. Be still, and in being still, you will become that reality for which we use the word God. You will not know it at all in the ordinary sense of the discriminative consciousness of a knowing subject looking at and recognizing an observed object. Not in that sense at all. God doesn't know that He is God. He just is God, and that's that. That's the total thing. You see, it's like that. It is knowing in that sense, by being still and by not obstructing this wonderful absolute power which never compels, which is desireless, which is infinite, which is perfect, from working itself out. And it works out through your psyche and my psyche. And as that power works, there takes place the transformation of all the ill in our own being. And there is the release of true beauty, perfect beauty. The face of the Divine King is perfect beauty. In the Kabbalistic teaching, designated by Tifereth, symbolically presented in the region of the heart, Anahata Center. That's the face of the King in His glory. It is called the Lesser Countenance. The countenance that smiles. The countenance that makes its light shine upon you when you are still and silent. And let the power of eternity work through you. It is very important to realize this. This is not a question, not a case of being passive in the wrong sense. It requires tremendous activity within us. The activity which is no disturbance, but which is a perfect dynamic poise. So intense, so wonderful, that divinity itself finds its full expression through it in you. So, our karma then as such is absolutely transformed. And the true meaning of the word karma becomes manifest in our being. Karma is derived from the root kri, which means to create. creative power, perpetually creating, perpetually perfect in itself. And if we can be free of all desire, of all our preconceptions and beliefs, and our tendency to make pictures for ourselves about the future and what we shall become, if we are free of all that, then this mystery of the divine alchemy takes place in our own being. You will find yourself transfigured. Transfigured to such an extent that some, at least, of those who have the good fortune to be near you will be able to see and to experience that inspiration which will take them forward to the fulfillment of their own eternal destiny.